Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Goins from the Reimagine Schools podcast, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another great episode of My EdTech Life. Thank you so much for joining us on this wonderful Thursday. Thank you, as always, for all of your support. We really appreciate it. And yesterday we had an amazing show, actually last night. So in a matter of a couple of hours, we've got two great, amazing guests that are here talking about AI in the higher ed space. But before we get into that conversation, as always, just thank you so much for all of your support. We really appreciate all the listens, the likes, the shares, the follows. Thank you so much to all our new YouTube subscribers. As you know, our mission is to get to 1,000 subscribers, and we're getting a little bit closer. So thank you all for your support. And again, I am excited about today's conversation. We are definitely going to be talking about AI in academia and transforming higher education. And today I have an amazing guest, Jason Guya, who's joining us. And Jason is somebody that I follow on LinkedIn. And if you haven't been following Jason on LinkedIn, please make sure that you do follow him. And we'll be sharing his information throughout the show and in the show notes. But please make sure that you follow, because he shares so much as far as practice, what he's been able to do, how he's transforming, his teaching method and what he does with the students at Berkeley. So I'm just really excited to learn a little bit more. Jason, how are you doing this morning?
I'm good. I'm super excited to be here and get to talk to you and get to talk about AI and everything that's happening with education because of it, or maybe not because of it. Who knows?
Yes. No. I'm so excited. And like I said, Jason, for our audience members who are joining us today or going to be catching this on the replay, who may not be very familiar with your work just yet, can you give us a little brief introduction and what your context is within the higher education space?
Yeah. So my journey to AI has been very zigzagging and all over the place. I don't have a background in AI. I am an English professor, so I teach at Berkeley College. So we're in New Jersey and New York. We have multiple campuses. And basically, I teach anything related to writing and the humanities. So, Composition 101, or what a lot of places call Composition 101, to advanced writing, social media writing. Now I am actually designing a course for us on AI-powered communication. It's kind of one of the big projects now that I'm designing from the bottom up. And so my journey has been sort of all over the place. So my PhD, believe it or not, is in 18th century allegory. So very, very, very niche. So English literature, really thinking about how stories create these fictional narratives that get us to basically engage with like these higher questions, right? A lot of times it was religious, other times it was just conceptual. And then I got my PhD, I started teaching at Berkeley, and I've just been teaching writing. So a lot of the times it's just nonfiction writing for a lot of our undergraduates, and just focusing on that. And from there, I actually started to get into AI, because when I first looked at ChatGPT, I was really worried. I had this kind of panic, and I had to really rethink writing. And one of the things that I've gradually learned is that my sort of zigzagging history has helped me out in many ways. So I actually have started to see connections between what's happening with AI and this technology and what happened in the 18th century. So that kind of broad historical approach, because one of the things that happened with the 18th century in England was Royal Society had all these scientific discoveries, one right after the other. So early part of the 18th century in England, most people didn't know that a germ existed. It wasn't a thing, right? There is a concept. And then, that was gradually discovered and all these things. And people had to deal with these scientific discoveries that actually were pretty disruptive of everyday life. So I've started to see these commonalities in terms of how we're dealing with things. So, think about writing, think about that historical context. And that got me to AI. And now that's a lot of what I do. I try to myself work AI into my classes, and I try to coach students, I coach faculty members, I coach administrators for how we can actually use this technology in our everyday lives and just to make our teaching a little bit better.
That's wonderful. And, you know, it's interesting, like you mentioned, just that comparison, you know, and I've always been a firm believer there really isn't anything new under the sun. It's just kind of wrapped in a different, you know, again, a different wrapper, a different presentation. But of course, obviously, with the advancements that we have and just moving a little bit faster, and of course, the immediacy of just having computers, supercomputers in our hands and being able to do so much. But you are absolutely right. And I think that even just like you described, that reaction to not knowing what a germ is, a lot of educators and actually everybody around the world, there are still many people like that, that are like, what is ChatGPT? What is this AI that everybody's talking about? Because believe it or not, last night when we were talking to Dr. Luke Hobson, I was talking about a summit that we had here in our area with some educators. And believe it or not, I'd probably say that maybe 90%, maybe 87, 90% still had not really taken the dive into just basic ChatGPT, and much less even some of the education apps that are out there that were being shared during that conference. So I'm just really excited to hear your perspective on the higher ed space, and especially being a humanities and teaching writing. I must say that writing has been my biggest pain point since far back as I could remember. And it could just be that maybe I just, you know, either didn't like it, or maybe it was just taught to me differently. But I'll tell you this, during my dissertation, or actually my doctoral program, if there was any way that I can get rid of or away from a writing or turning something in writing, I definitely did. And my professors allowed me to many times do podcasts or do videos, because I don't know, it's just that fear that for me, writing has always been so punitive, in the sense of, oh, you know, here I need a 20-page paper. The content is great, but you missed one citation, minus 20, you get a B. And that was the fear. It's so punitive. And are we writing for stamina? Are you actually reading the content? So can you tell us a little bit about how maybe through, well, how this year with ChatGPT and many other apps out there, and through your work, maybe you've adapted your coursework for your students? And maybe if you can share maybe a success story with maybe somebody that may feel the same way I did in, or in your class, and how they've been able to grow.
Yeah. And your experience at the summit very much jives with my own experience. One of the things that I've gradually learned now that I train and have worked with hundreds and hundreds of faculty is that if you walk into a room with 100 faculty members or whatever the number is, and you ask about just ChatGPT or really any AI, you'll get a huge range of reactions. Right? So I would say that, yeah, about 90% of people, of faculty members, haven't really used it. They might've gone in, they might've plugged in like a very basic search inquiry, been dissatisfied with the answer and just went off and did something else and just marked and said, all right, so that wasn't worth it, right? And then they don't go back to it. So I think that's very much the case. And so, yeah, and in terms of writing, I think the idea of writing as a pain point is so interesting, because that's the case for a lot of us. I'm going to be totally honest. Writing was a pain point for me until I got to college. And I teach writing and I write all the time. I hated writing in elementary school, middle school, and high school. And so for me, it wasn't so much about the fear, which I totally get, that kind of focus on the punitive side. And now that in many ways just makes it hard to get started. But for me, writing felt very uncreative, because I didn't want, even when I was in middle school and high school, I didn't want to write a 5-paragraph essay. I didn't do it, right? And so they actually, I might've been marked down on paper because I didn't fit into what they wanted me to write as. I wanted to do it a little bit more dynamically, a little bit more differently. And so one of the things that I try to use AI to do is I try to empower my students to actually do the kind of writing that they want. And this, especially early on in a semester, sometimes shocks my students, because they come in and they fully think that I'm going to give them a form to stick to, right? And it's going to be plug and play, because that's for a lot of how they've been taught, right? Here is what I want you to do. In paragraph number one, put in this information, end with an argument. Paragraph number two, point one, paragraph two, like that sort of like very basic format. And originally, so I start off a lot of my classes basically teaching them, whether it's online or in person, that I'm not going to do that, that I'm going to give them a slightly different way of writing. And I give them a lot of agency. And I think agency makes a huge difference. And for many contexts, this might not work. So when I teach literature, and I believe for me, literature, I actually don't really ever use the word. I just talk about stories. Anything that is a story is literature. I don't care if it's a podcast, movie, TV show, book, poem, anything, right? It's just about telling stories. And so in my classes, one of the things I do, if I'm teaching stories, I will give some of them that kind of traditional essay that they want, you know, give me an argument, give me the evidence, that sort of stuff. But I also work in creative writing. And I sometimes will use ChatGPT to do this. So one of the assignments that I did for my students, and I gave this as an option, not everyone had to do this. So I gave them a story, I think it was by Stephen King. And it's kind of a fun story with a big twist at the ending. So I gave them that story. It's short, it's punchy. I think it just kind of gets your interest. And one of the assignments was to basically lay out a sequel, right? What's the next thing that can happen, right? What happens in the future, right? And so lay it out. They actually don't even have to write that much, just a basic outline. And then ask ChatGPT to do it, right? So go in and prompt it, see what you get out of it, and look at them side by side, right? See what the connections are, what the similarities are, what the differences are. And that is something to write about. So I actually do it as a reflective piece, right? So reflect on how you approached it differently. So what I'm trying to do there is I'm trying to do a couple of things. One, I want them to use writing as a way of just figuring things out, right? So it's not just a template to kind of plug in. It actually is there is a way that it can be dynamic and interesting. And it really is just showing your thoughts on the paper, at least for some writers. And then also just thinking about, well, basically practicing metacognition, right? Thinking about how you approach it and how something like a robot, you know, an AI would approach it. And that's something that my students find very, very interesting. I think some of them are interested just because they haven't looked at the tech that much, right? I still have students who are still getting used to it, right? Students have a pretty big range too in terms of how comfortable they are or are not with AI. And some of them were just sort of shocked by that other approach. And I think that one of the obstacles for how students approach writing, really how all of us approach writing, is we have this ivory model tower, right? It's in academia everywhere, but it's really in writing, right? So this idea that writing is something you do in isolation. You go and you read something, you lock yourself in a room, and you don't leave until you've completed whatever you're trying to produce. And for a lot of us, anything that moves writing into a social space, I think helps them out. And yes, in a perfect world, it would be done with humans, but human-to-human interaction involves judgment. It involves, you know, this fear that the other person is going to take that punitive approach. I think when I was a student, when I was peer reviewing, I just assumed that my peer reviewer would take the same approach as the teacher, right? So being punitive, tell me what I did wrong. And so using AI is a way to get students just writing and connecting with something, getting feedback from something, I think helps them get from step zero to step one or step one to step two. And that's the power of the tech, just helping students kind of get an introduction to writing and just kind of getting past that blank page, which is so difficult for many students.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. Like you said, it's just for me, just seeing what assignment I had to do. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Luckily, you know, one of the things I must say during my program, you know, the professors that I have had were very great at working with us at writing and helping us out throughout the process and so on. But I must say they did make it less difficult, a little bit better for me, but still it was just that fear and trauma of just, you know, I remember my freshman year in college back in 1999, and we had to do the note cards and our citations and things of that sort. And believe it or not, there are still some teachers within our district that still teach the note cards and so on, even though I've shown them like, hey, there's some, websites that, you know, students can plug this in. Oh, no, but they need to know this. they must know how to do, you know, citations properly. And I was like, I don't know the last time that I had to do that properly. You know, if I could just put it in APA 7th edition and submit, it's been great. So my citations have been good. It's just working on the writing and going to what you said. You know, the interesting thing about the TAC, being able to this last semester before starting now in my dissertation phase, being able to take my professor's rubric and upload it into ChatGPT and then compare my paragraph and go one paragraph at a time. That was something that was so alleviating for me to be able to get that immediate feedback, because like you mentioned, sometimes writing in silos, it causes a lot of anxiety. You don't have, you know, maybe somebody to run this by, because of obviously they may not be, you know, what, you know, taking the same coursework, and then maybe your professor's busy and they can't get back to you with enough time. So being able to do that really helped me out. And so much so that I shared this with my professors during the summer, and they said, hey, Fons, can you come into one of our classes in a Zoom session and show our students how you're using ChatGPT to be able to help you with the writing process and give you some feedback and so on? And that was something that was great. And so I really love that, to be able to share that with, you know, my fellow classmates and allow them to grow and learn the tech. And my professors now are really embracing the tech. And even now in dissertation, they're like, oh yeah, go ahead and do this, go ahead and do that. And if you need to, you know, just plug it into ChatGPT and, you know, or Claude or whatever, and do this, this and that. And I was like, oh my goodness, like my professor is so cool, and he was able to adapt to this. So I want to ask you, you know, I know you've mentioned how you've been able to adapt, but as far as everybody else that you work with, because like you mentioned, you do help train a lot of the faculty, what have you seen and what has been the biggest challenge for them, you know, as they've been introduced to this tech throughout this year?
Yeah, I've been training faculty since about February of last year. So, or I guess this year. So it's still 2023.
It feels like a year.
I'm in 2024 mentally, apparently. Yes. So basically a few months after ChatGPT, I got my first call to train faculty. And so I've been doing it for just under a year. About 6 months in, I radically changed my approach for higher ed. And the reason was that I started to learn something, and something that surprised me. So the original way I was training, I think, made sense at the time, right? So just start off giving them a use case, right? Here's something really cool you can do with AI. I've done it with ChatGPT. I've done Gamma, which was very, very cool for professors, especially if they're, so this is a PowerPoint creating program. There are a lot of others, Beautiful AI, Tome I Know is another big one, but basically being able to give it a prompt and get some version of a presentation. So I would show them that, and then I would focus on practical uses. I'd give them some prompts, and then at the end, we would talk about ethics. We'd have this basic discussion. I changed my approach. I got about 6 months in, and I realized something. I wasn't really recognizing how much of an obstacle, maybe that's not the right word, but how big the ethical concerns were. That approach of having ethics kind of put at the end was not working. Because as I talked to more and more faculty, I learned that for many of them, so for some of them, yes, it's just one other thing to learn and they just don't have time for it. That's certainly there as an excuse for not using this technology. But for some others, and there's actually a huge portion of faculty that I talk to who say this, they think AI is unethical. They think it is immoral. They think touching it taints you, right? And whenever I talk to faculty, I don't belittle that. I understand the concerns. I get what it's getting at. Although I think a lot of that is because they haven't used the tech before. And so if you're just reading about it in an abstract way, you kind of lose something about how this tech is working and what you can do with it. But one of the things that I do now is I change how I approach training. Because I think that for higher ed, in the higher ed space, that focus on ethics and morality and what we can do, what we shouldn't do with this technology has to always be a part of the conversation. And even just telling faculty, you know, giving them even like a minute during a presentation to just talk about that, I think helps a ton. because I think it's a very delicate balance when we need to be thinking about not just the use cases, because I think we all want those, we want to see them and see how we can be more efficient or more effective with AI. But we also want to think, especially in the higher ed space, about the larger things that are happening. Right. If I can go and generate something with ChatGPT, what does that mean for critical thinking? Right. And having those little things where, you know, for me, we can actually use AI to improve critical thinking and encourage it. But I have to say that, right? You can have that as like an implicit idea, because I think that that has been a huge obstacle for getting AI into the higher ed space. And a few months ago, I was on, I think I was on X or Twitter. It feels so weird to call it X, but anyway, I was on X and I went and there was an English professor at like a big institution and they wrote something along the lines of, we all just need to agree that AI needs to be banned from every single writing classroom, period. And if we don't agree on this, then what are we doing? So, and I have many problems with that. The big problem is you can't do it. Right. It's actually just like not even possible. Right. And I think that's another thing. Right. Another way that I approach talking to faculty is focusing on what you can control, because keeping AI out of the classroom completely and out of that assignments completely is just, it is not scalable. Right? Even if we theoretically, we can't, but even if we could theoretically do it today, we can't do it in a month, right? We can't do it in a year, right? There's a moment when that model breaks apart. And so we can either spend our time bolstering and supporting that model until it breaks apart, or we can start to plan for the next thing and start to think about that future. Because now it is a matter of just figuring out how we can use our time. But for me, you know, focusing on faculty on, you know, controlling what you can control and really having those big social ethical questions always a part of the conversation in my training has also helped, because if we just have use cases when we're training, we might get someone to play with the tech for 10 minutes, but when they get home, they're not going to, right? Because that feeling of immorality is going to nag at it and they're just going to put it aside. And so I think that even just having a space where faculty members and administrators and staff can actually just think about that, I think makes a huge difference, at least in my trainings.
Yeah. So I want to ask, you know, now you are doing the trainings with your faculty, but what has been the overall stance for your institution on the use of AI? And that's a similar question I asked Dr. Hobson yesterday, because I know, you know, as much as we don't like to work in silos, I know that many times we're siloed by departments as far as, you know, humanities and so on. So the training that you do, is that offered for everybody at your college, or is it just for your specific faculty in humanities? And can you tell us about the overall stance as far as the institution on AI?
Yeah, so my institution has been great. They've been incredibly accepting of AI and its use and how it can be worked into the classroom. And that's because we are a career-focused institution. We have as really a huge part of our mission, getting students jobs. And I think that has helped me out a lot. So when I talk to administrators about it, I really amp that up, because as we know now, being able to use AI is going to be a major skill in the workforce. Right. And that's going to, I think, continue to be the case. And it's certainly going to be the case for the next 5-10 years, that having AI literacy is going to be a differentiator for our students. And so that has helped me, my institution, just really make the case that we shouldn't ban it. I was worried, because when ChatGPT came out, I was actually on sabbatical. So I was sort of like distanced from things, and I felt very worried that we're going to get a ban. And I was very happy that we didn't. They've been accepting along the way. I've been doing training with our faculty along the way, and I also do training at other institutions when they just have me on as a consultant. But I have gotten very, very little friction and pushback when I say I'm working AI into my classrooms. And I do think part of that is because we're a career-centered institution. We want to get our students jobs. And also, we do not have a formal AI policy on the college level. Our approach has been very professor-centered, and at least I want it to be more student-centered. I want them to have a huge voice in it too. So one of the things that I do in my classes, which my institution has fully backed me up on, is I create the AI policy with my students. I let them weigh in on it. I let them tell me their concerns, you know, how they, what they want to learn to do with it, what they think is unethical, right? What they perceive as unethical. And out of that, we work together. We collaborate to create an AI policy. Now, that will not fly at all institutions, right? I have that because I have a lot of leeway. And eventually, I think we'll have a college-wide policy. But for us, we've had the ability to create our AI policies from the ground up. That in and of itself is a challenge. One of the things that I do at my college is I provide support for faculty who are trying to decide on a policy. Right. I give them samples. I walk them through, you know, here are some questions to think about. If you are going to do blank, really think about this, right? Because no matter what your policy is, there are obstacles that you need to approach and things you have to have built into your AI policy. But my institution has been great with it. Now, I know that many other colleges and universities have pushed for like a top-down AI policy, which has advantages, right? Especially when you talk about the appeals process. When a student is, and this is one of those things that I know is happening, I'm more than happy to talk about it because I've talked to a lot of people about it. When a student is accused of using AI to plagiarize, and then it gets into the appeals process. So the student says, no, I didn't. And then you're in this very, very weird situation. So in that case, yeah, you kind of want a college-wide policy, but there are certain advantages to just giving professors and students the ability to kind of create them as we go along. So yeah, every institution, every college has their own sort of obstacles with how they're approaching this technology and where the policy is coming from.
There you go. And that's great. That's good to hear. You know, like I said, because, you know, right now, as even though it's been a year, like you said, it kind of took off full steam, like, oh my gosh, that panic and that uproar. And then for a lot of us that are real tech savvy, we're like, woohoo, the next big thing. And we're just, you know, rolling with it and going and adapting and so on. But tell me a little bit about kind of what you've seen in that adoption process. Have you seen that, you know, since last year when ChatGPT came out and the work that you're doing, have you kind of feel that higher ed has continually moved faster, or do you feel that there's been kind of like a little slowdown or a little lull within the adoption process?
I think there's been a slowdown. I think so. When ChatGPT came out in November, I think there was broad panic. Colleges, professors, and students too, they're also a part of this disruption, really not being sure what to do, right? Do we ban it, right? That was thrown out as a possibility at many, many colleges. Do we incorporate it? How do we incorporate it? What does that look like? Should we create a degree for it, right? Some institutions took that approach. And so there was this broad kind of confusion and panic. And then, so I'd say that really hit like January. And then by the time we got to like March, I think, at least for me, I became more and more optimistic. It seemed like there was an uptick in how colleges were adopting it, how they were moving around, how they were working AI into their mission statements, right? Explicitly or implicitly saying that, you know, we want our students to get jobs. So this is how AI fits into what we are trying to do for our students and how we are serving them. Then I think the summer hit. I think everything went on pause. The initiatives that were in place went on pause. People went off, student and professor alike, and they did their own thing for a couple of months. And I don't think it picked up where it left off. I think that September came, some institutions, some individuals kept things going, kept things moving. But I think that in general, things were much, much slower. And I don't know if it's just because of everything that happened with the news, and there were so many developments for those couple of months, especially in July and August, or if people started to see it as a phase, or they just lost touch with it. And I kind of think that that happened too. One of the big obstacles for faculty is how quickly AI changes. And my first pieces of advice for faculty, especially those who have an online presence, is when you go online and you see those lists of 100 AI tools that have been released in the last 2 months that will make you more productive and make you superhuman. Do not read those. Just ignore them. Table them for various reasons. The big one is that it is just so overwhelming. And we are at a point where I think we have to be very practical and very diplomatic with just how much we're asking people to do, right? It's really a hard sell to say, you know, learn all these 10 programs. Like, no, just pick one that you think is useful. Learn that really well. That is way better than learning 10 or 20 or 100 AI tools. So I think that when we came back in September after the summer, overwhelm was just so powerful. And a lot of people just couldn't get past it, especially when you're thinking about like the entire academic year, right? So you try to be very, very purposeful in September with what you're taking on and not taking on. I think a lot of us are anyway. And so, yeah, I think it slowed down a lot. And what I'm trying to get people to do and faculty to do and colleges to do is to think now strategically, right? Think about what we want the colleges and the individual professors' strategy for using this technology to be.
I love it. I love it.
I think that that's going to be the big, I'm hoping that's going to be the big change, because I don't think it's just going to be like hitting the accelerate pedal again. I don't think that's the case. It's going to be about like thinking about it slightly differently, right? Maybe this is a case. Now that things have slowed down, it is our chance to focus less on the tools, which kind of took over last year, and more on the strategy behind things. That's what I'm trying to do anyway.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I absolutely agree with you 100%, because I mean, when this thing took off, there was everything, apps. I mean, there were just really the wrappers, and it was fancy, and it was like a huge cash grab, money grab, pay $5.99 for this, pay $10.99 for this. And coming in from the education space and the K-12 space, Jason, I got to tell you, one of the things that I often see is a lot of app hopping, going from app to app to app to app. And I mean, sometimes it's really, to me, like borderline addiction sort of style, because it's like you want to be on that next big thing, because you either, you know, want to post it on social media, you want to do this, you want to be the first, you want to try it out. And for a lot of educators, it's that fear of missing out, because it's like, oh man, so-and-so is doing it, I want to do it too, so now I'm going to implement it. And now you're just using the app because somebody else is using it, and you think that you're going to get the same results, but you may not, because they may be using it differently than you are. And so a lot of that happens. And one of the things that I'm all about, like you mentioned, keeping it simple and practical. And my philosophy this year has been kiss your AI, keep it simple and streamlined. And I'm with you that it's not about the plethora of tools that are out there that you know that you can use, but it's about that quality of education. And obviously the engineering a wonderful lesson. As teachers, I like to call them learning engineers, engineering a wonderful lesson that can engage the students and, yes, use some of these apps to enhance the learning. But at the end, the teacher is that engineer that's going to go ahead and elevate that lesson too as well. So I always love the practical sense, like you're saying, you know, use 2 to 3 apps that you're completely comfortable with that are going to get you to your, you know, complete your learning objective, check for understanding, check for learning, and that the student has mastered it. And oftentimes it's like, we just, here, let's try this. And you just want to engage them. But like you mentioned earlier, maybe like they'll be good for like 10 minutes. And then after that, it's like, this again. And it's like, seems like the teacher's more excited than the student, but it's because we're not letting the students lead the tech. And that's one thing that you mentioned way earlier that I love, that allowing students that voice and choice in what tech they want to use and how they want to learn this, because, you know, who better to learn than from the final users of this product? And at the end, they're the ones that are learning. And so that's one thing that I love. So I know at the summit that we did, I didn't even present on any tools at all. I really wanted to touch on that human aspect, because like you mentioned, that 90% of people maybe in a room like you yourself have seen have not even touched ChatGPT, or they just feel paralyzed because of how overwhelmed they feel of everything that is out there. So my presentation was just kiss your AI, talking to them about how to keep it simple. You're on your own journey. Forget the fear of missing out and just dive in deep, learn yourself, feel comfortable. And just really, it was great that I got some good feedback from some educators there that are like, this is what I needed. There's so much out there and it was so overwhelming. And I just want to say thank you, because you just made this so easy and so simple for me to just take that first step. Because again, we can just say, okay, 10 apps to use tomorrow that are going to, you know, do this, 100 apps to do. And, you know, we forget that our audience, and many in our audience are at different levels. So that was very helpful. The other thing that you touched on too as well that I really liked is how important it is to really find those apps that are going to help the student. And you mentioned about, workforce ready skills or future of work skills. So I want to ask you, through your class and your coursework that you do, what are some of the skills that the students are not only developing in just learning humanities, but what are some of the skills that they're learning also as well to be future ready?
The big thing that I have my students practicing and being very, very reflective about is AI literacy. I think that this is one of those big skills. And one of the things that I try to emphasize for my students, as well as any trainee that I have, is that I actually don't think AI literacy is a new thing. I don't think it is a new skill. I don't think it is a newfangled skill. I don't think it's a shiny skill. I think it's information literacy, just kind of a subtopic underneath that. So our college has been teaching information literacy literally for decades, right? Being able to look at what's out there and figure out how things connect to each other and how you fit in that kind of broader tapestry. And now AI is just added to that, right? AI, in many ways, is simply another way to deliver information. Sometimes it's good information, sometimes it's bad information. And so a lot of the sifting that we have to do is actually very similar to what we've been teaching our students to do for a long time. And I actually think in the workforce, this is one of those differentiators, right? Showing your AI literacy, because AI literacy for me isn't just using a tool, right? There are people out there who are creating awesome things, right? There are millions of people creating awesome things with AI right now, today. And yes, that's a great skill. But AI literacy, and the way that I encourage my students to think about it, is so much more about reflection and so much more about being self-conscious about how we're using the technology. So one of the things that I have my students do, and this is something that I actually changed a couple months ago, it's a brand new change, is so we use Canvas as our LMS. And one of the things that dawned to me is how empty the comments are, right? Students submit, there's usually sometimes a question in the comment. And it dawned on me, why can't the comment be a part of the assignment? Why not, right? And so that actually allowed me to think about an LMS is a little bit more like a portfolio. So I had students submit something, right? Sometimes it's a podcast. I actually had some students create companion websites in my literature class. And I had them use the comment function as a way to show their AI literacy, right? I gave them a reflective question, right? So if they use a prompt, I asked them to reflect on that prompt, right? And that kind of pushed them to, I think in a broader way about how they're interacting with this technology. And another activity that I do with my students, which I think is a lot of fun, is so for all of my classes, I give them a scale, right? So if an assignment is a 1, it means no AI allowed, right? Pretty rare. But if a student is doing free writing or something like that, certainly possible and valuable. And then there's a 5, which is like full on AI literacy, or just AI created, right? You're giving it the prompts, but in general, you're just using, you might be revising it, but you're using something that is AI generated. Now, again, pretty rare. Most of the time, students are in the middle, right? They're 2, 3, or 4. And I ask my students, so for a particular assignment, I'll give them a number, especially early on. Later, they can pick their own number. So I might say, oh, for this, try to be around a 2, maybe a 3 if you need more help. And in the comments, I'll ask them to reflect on that, right? And this is them showing AI literacy, saying that, if you were a 2, what happens if you ended up to a 5? What would be different, right? What would you lose? What would you gain, right? And because for me, whenever we pick up a tool, and this is for all tools, this is not just AI, something is gained, something is lost, right? If I write something by hand and then I move to a computer, I gain something and lose something, right? Then I move to a phone, I gain something and lose something. It's just how tools work. And so I'm trying to get my students to show their AI literacy, because that is something that I think they're going to need, right? They're going to need to bring into an interview and say that, this is how I can not just learn the technology, they'll have to be able to show that, but also think self-consciously about how I'm interacting with it, right? Because I think that it's going to be a huge thing. So I actually work AI literacy. And again, for me, it's just a subtopic under information literacy into all of my courses. And I've done that with comments. I might do that with more of a portfolio kind of projects and more project-based learning in the future. That's something that I'm tinkering with and figuring out what it would look like. So I think that's certainly a possibility going forward. But that's one of the big skills I have my students practicing and demonstrating in a very real way as much as they can.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Now, before we wrap up, I have one more question, but going along these lines, I would love for you to share, you know, I heard you on the Everyday AI podcast and you shared an assignment that you gave, how you created, you know, the ChatGPT prompt, and then you shared it with your students and how they went back and forth. So I thought that that was so impressive and so innovative and such a great way to be able to use AI in the classroom and especially with writing. So can you share a little bit of that assignment with us and how that went?
Yeah, it's very dynamic, I find. My students like it and it's simple, right? It sticks to, like, here's a simple use case of it. So I use this to teach argumentation. A lot of us teach that, especially if you're teaching writing, being able to look at evidence and figure out what your argument is. And I think that going forward, that's going to be a huge skill because we're going to ask our students to look online, find information, evidence out there, and figure out what they think based off of the evidence and connect things. And so the traditional way of doing that was the 5-paragraph essay. Right? Announce an argument at the very end of that introduction, and then back it up with reason number one, reason number two, reason number three. And now my experience as a student is I hated this. I refused to do it. I found it uncreative. I didn't find it that interesting. So one of the things that I do with my writing students is I keep that focus on argumentation and creating an argument, but I use AI to make it much more interesting, I think. And also it helps me see what they're doing. So what I do is I have students go into ChatGPT and I give them a prompt. The prompt is about a page and a half to 2 pages. It's really, really long. I have a ton of instructions for ChatGPT for what to do. And if anyone listening does want that prompt, just let me know, message me through LinkedIn, I'll send it right to you. I'm more than happy to share it. And so what it allows students to do, and I ask them to copy and paste the entire prompt. I could do it as a chatbot if I wanted to, but I want them to see the prompt. I want them to, like, see what it's like and look through it, at least a little bit, just kind of give it a skim. But basically what the prompt does is it asks ChatGPT to act as a contrarian. And I let it know exactly what that is. It's not going to just take the opposite side. It's going to do something a little bit more complex because they're college students. So it's not just about, like, just a debate and arguing just for one side. It's about really thinking about how complex the idea is. So ChatGPT in the prompt is asked to basically look at the argument that the student is giving them and poke holes in it and focus on the assumptions and ask questions about it. So basically, a student will go in, copy that prompt, ChatGPT will just say, okay, something like that, it knows the directions, and then a student gives them their idea, and they have a dialogue with ChatGPT. And in the upper right part of the screen on ChatGPT, they can just send me the entire link to the chat, right? Because I want to see everything. And honestly, I learn much, much more from this than I ever do from a 5-paragraph essay, because I don't get to just see the argumentation skills. I want to look at that, but that's only one thing. I also get to see their AI literacy. Right? How are they interacting with the chatbot? When I first assigned this, I had a false assumption. I assumed that all of my students were going to know exactly how to interact with ChatGPT, right? I thought, all right, great, it's going to be fine. And that was not the case at all. I was astounded by how big the range was. Some students were perfectly comfortable with it, did not miss a beat. If ChatGPT said something pushing against them, they would either push back or ask a question or take a different approach and show that they were actually interacting with what ChatGPT was giving them. Other students just didn't know how to do it, right? They either gave up, that certainly happened, right? Either early on in the chat or at the end, sometimes ChatGPT just wins, right? And the idea that the student really, really believed in at the beginning of the chat changed for various reasons. And other times, and these are the ones I found really interesting, I had students who just didn't know how to interact with it, like at all, right? They just didn't know how to like read and respond. And I want to see that. I would have missed that in a 5-paragraph essay if students were just doing that kind of template style writing and kind of pass it off. I would have missed that. This gives me the ability to give them support, right? So that I can say, oh, I noticed this sort of interaction, and then I can give them resources, or we can have a chat, like whatever would be useful for them to kind of focus on that. So I can pinpoint in a much more streamlined way than I have in the past. And at least for me, they don't take that much. It's not like a huge lift grading it, because I actually think they're really interesting, right? I think it's much more interesting to read that than a 5-paragraph essay, because for me as an instructor, burnout hits when I'm just not interested in reading something. And if you have, say, 100 students who are writing a 5-paragraph essay and they don't want to write it, that feeds into it, right? It becomes less and less interesting as a professor to read through it. So just being able to kind of switch things up a little bit, have that assignment, and again, just being able to get more information about their AI literacy, how they're thinking through their ideas, I think is so invaluable. And I think the traditional way of teaching misses it, because most of my students, especially by the time they get to college, even if they don't really know how to create an argument or synthesize information, they've learned how to fake it. And it's way easier to do that in a 5-paragraph essay than a ChatGPT dialogue, especially when they're just giving me the whole thing.
Oh, I love it. And that's so great. I mean, you hit on so many things that I love. It's just really the immediacy of that feedback too as well, being able to learn and pinpoint. And like you mentioned, you know, that's something that you might have missed in that traditional assignment where they're just writing and you miss a lot of that. And now, like Sophie was commenting earlier, you know, maybe some professors might, like she had a teacher that said, hey, my teacher always said, or my prof always said that my writing was vanilla, but never gave me any feedback on how to improve it, you know. And now here, through the use of ChatGPT, not only are they learning how to create that argument, you know, but also write and interact. And I think that's something that is such a valuable skill, like you mentioned, and I absolutely love it. So please, anybody listening and you want that prompt, please make sure that you message Jason on LinkedIn, and you can find definitely the link on the show notes, and I've been posting it here in the comments. So make sure that you reach out to him as well. Well, Jason, just the last question before we wrap up, I want to ask you, you know, based on your experiences and observations and everything that you've done with AI this past year, where do you see AI headed in the higher ed space for this coming year of 2024?
My hope, my sincere hope, is that the higher ed space will start to get past the hype. I think that this last year, even for individuals who are really gung-ho about using it, hype has like affected how we've approached it. And we talked about this already, right? The idea that we want to just work tools in there just because they're flashy and cool. And a lot of us, myself included, tend to overestimate how much students will be engaged by a tool, right? I think, oh, this is really cool. I give it to students like, oh, so what, right? You get that sort of like gap in terms of how they see it versus how I see it. So 2024, I'm hoping, keep pushing, I think it can get there, is going to be the year that higher ed thinks about practical application, right? Thinks about strategy, thinks about if we want to work AI into our colleges, into our classrooms, how can we do it with purpose? Because I think even for those who are really innovative and played with this technology, I think that was kind of pushed to the side. Right now, I think we need to bring it back to the center. So, and that really means bringing the student back to the center, right? What's the purpose for that student? And ask the student about it, right? Have them in the conversation. One of the things that I didn't love about 2023 is how rarely students were asked about AI, how rarely they were brought into the conversation. Now, I see them starting to be worked in more. I did a keynote presentation at Seton Hall a couple months ago, and it was a presentation they wanted like 20, 30 minutes, so relatively short. But what they really wanted me on after that was the panel. And 30% or so of the panel was students. That's where I'm hoping we're heading. I think we're getting there. Because I think if you're having, if you have an AI committee, you should have a student on it, right? If you have presentations for your faculty, right, have students on them. My experience has been if you approach a student and you say, oh, would you like to talk to faculty and other students about AI and be on this council or committee or whatever, they're so gung-ho about it, right? They're so, because they're being listened to. And traditionally, students are not listened to. So I'm hoping we're going to push through that hype, think about practical applications, think about strategy, and just get students in on the conversation more and more, because that's what I think needs to happen in 2024. And I think it can. I think we just have to keep pushing for it.
I love it. Thank you, Jason. I really appreciate all your amazing shares today. This has been an amazing and fruitful conversation. I know my bucket is full this morning with so much learning that I did. And I know our audience members too. We had huge number over here on Instagram and LinkedIn and everybody that's watching us live. So thank you so much, Sophie, Amanda, and you know all the others that were joining us with the comments. Thank you so much. I really appreciate all your support. But Jason, before we wrap up, I always love to end the show with the last three questions. So I hope that you are ready here. So
I'm ready. Go for it.
Awesome. My first question is, we know that every superhero has a weakness. And for Superman, kryptonite was his weakness, or a pain point, I should say. So for yourself, in the current state of higher ed or AI in higher ed, what would you say is your current AI higher ed kryptonite?
I get too excited. And I mean this in like a real way. I don't mean this in like a, oh, I'm too generous sort of way. My excitement does get in my way sometimes. I need people to pull me back, right? To actually come in and say, oh, what are the big questions here? What should we really be thinking about? And I need that. When I look at something, my basic idea is I'm just curious. I want to play. I want to touch. I want to like do that sort of stuff. And that is great sometimes. Every once in a while, it just gets me in trouble. And I need people to pull me back.
Okay, great answer. I love it. I think you and I are very similar in that aspect where sometimes it's like, whoa, slow down a bit because I want to go a million miles an hour. But again, it's just, we want to push the envelope. We want to get people, everybody at the same level. And we really do get excited genuinely. So I love it. All right, here we go. Question number two is, if you could have a billboard with anything on it, what would it be and why?
Experiment, just play with things. And, you know, obviously be purposeful about it, right? Be careful about it. But I think the beauty of right now and AI right now is that we can have low stakes experiments in a way that we never really could, right? We don't have to spend hours or days or weeks doing something. We can try something out for 20 minutes, an hour, try out blank whatever we want, see how it works, right? Especially with help of AI, and reassess. So just be willing to experiment and be willing to tell students when you're experimenting. As I was going to grad school and became a professor, I felt like I needed to be an expert in everything. I felt like if I just tried something different, my students would feel like I was cheating them out of something, right? Because I would be talking about something that I'm not experimenting on, something I didn't have fully fledged out. And I found exactly the opposite. My students like it when I say, you know what? I want to try something different. Let's do this together. And I think that's made all the difference. So just experiment and be vulnerable about when you're experimenting.
Love it. Great advice. And Christine Stoltz says here, you are doing great, Jason. So big shout out, Jason, from Christine. All right. And the last question, Jason, is, do you have a hobby or favorite activity that you wish you could turn into a full-time profession? And if so, what would it be?
Reading. It's such like a bad answer. It's such like a traditional. Oh yeah. It's the one hobby that I've kept going. I have other things that I've done, but I have a 3-year-old and a 3-month-old. So a lot of the hobbies have been like pushed to the side. But just reading, engaging with information that way. I am a complete sucker for printed books. I know, you know, I should be, everything should be virtual now. But I like printed books. I like having something that will not interact with me. right? There's something nice about that still. And so, yeah, reading. And I have no idea how I would do that except teach.
There you go. Excellent. Well, I love it too. I'm a sucker for printed books too, as well. And like you said, there's just something about just leafing through the pages and highlighting and underlining and writing notes. It just really is something great. And like you said, I never thought about that aspect of just having something that doesn't interact with you. But then I started thinking, yeah, I've actually tried to do like reading on my phone or an iPad and accidentally go to another app. And then I just lose myself and just, get distracted. So I absolutely love that. Well, Jason, thank you. I appreciate you taking some time this morning out of your schedule. I know, like you said, you've got a 3-month-old and a 3-year-old. So thank you so much for making some time to be here and sharing your insight with my audience. And like I said, you definitely dropped some great truth bombs, some great knowledge, and our audience is definitely going to be benefiting from it as well. And so thank you. And so make sure that you follow Jason. Everybody, I have been sharing the link throughout the comments, and you will find all of that in the show notes. And to all our audience that joined us live, I appreciate all the comments, all the love. Thank you so much, Sophie, Thomas, Alice, Amanda, Christine, all of you that joined us, and everybody on Instagram and LinkedIn also that are dropping in your comments. Appreciate you all. And of course, if you want to make sure that if you're going to be checking out this episode on the replay, or you're listening to it on the replay, or if you want to hear some more amazing episodes of My EdTech Life, please make sure you visit our website at myedtech.life, where you can check out this amazing episode and another 259 wonderful episodes with education practitioners, founders, co-founders. You will find a little bit about everything that I promise you. You'll find some knowledge nuggets specifically for you that you can definitely sprinkle onto what you are already doing great. If you haven't followed us yet on socials, please make sure you follow us on all socials at MyEdTechLife, at MyEdTechLife on all socials. And if you haven't subscribed to our YouTube channel, please jump over, give us a thumbs up, subscribe. We're on a mission to get to 1,000 subscribers. And I want to thank you all for all of your support, those of you that have already subscribed. So thank you so much for all the love, all the shares, the follows. Like I said, we do what we do for you so we can bring you some amazing content, some amazing guests, and just amazing conversations that can help you grow personally and professionally. So thank you for joining us this morning. And as always, my friends, don't forget, stay techie.